You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is currently accepting applications for Northern New Mexico Tribal Business Scholarships. These awards are for Native American students attending four-year undergraduate programs in business-related fields in or out of New Mexico. The application deadline is June 15th. For more information, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. That's lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. Or call 505-753-8890, extension 115. I'm very happy now to welcome Tomas Rivera. He's executive director of the Chainbreaker Collective in Santa Fe. They're an economic and environmental justice organization. They're working on issues of affordable transportation, housing, sustainable communities in the city of Santa Fe and in this area. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to have you. You started off Chainbreaker started about 15 years ago as an organization that I remember kind of well. It promoted bicycles in Santa Fe. Tell us a little bit about that history.
That's right. Yes. We started off 15 years ago doing bicycle recycling. Chainbreaker is as grassroots as it gets. We started off in storage sheds. Our first place was one that we built ourselves out of old wood pallets. So those are kind of our roots, and our flagship project was a bicycle recycling program that helped people who can afford a bike to get one. And we still do that to this day. It's our bicycle resource center. We've given out over 3,000 bikes through it in the last 15 years. It's an education program that helps people learn the mechanics of how to fix up their own bike and how to do safe riding. And then they trade those bicycles for 4 hours of volunteer time.
All of that led into work involving not only bicycles, but transportation systems in the city and environs. And it is a real question that I wanted to ask you about people who were dependent on transport other than cars in Santa Fe, and how Chainbreaker has been kind of looking at that whole issue of car dependency and the, you know, when people don't have cars and access to cars, what's going on?
So yeah, I think our natural evolution as an organization came from this bicycle program that we were doing. It was very loose-knit, and a lot of the folks that were coming to us started helping us understand that just giving bikes to people was just really just the start of something that we could do much more so. And this became much more evident to us when the economy started collapsing around 2007 and 2008, and people were losing their homes and having to deal with rising gas prices that were at that point $4 a gallon. So more and more people were coming to us saying that they couldn't afford to drive their cars anymore. And people were really faced with this issue of having to choose between paying their rent and keeping their cars. Chainbreaker was in a position to address this issue because of the history that we had at that point of doing bicycle work and doing transportation work. And so our natural next step was to start really shoring up our organization and becoming more organized and less ad hoc. And so we formed the organization, we started recruiting members, and the first place we started talking to people to do organizing was on buses, because that was just a natural step for us. So many of the folks we talked to were riding the bus because they couldn't afford a car, because they had their license revoked, because, for various reasons, they just couldn't drive a car. So we started talking to them about those issues, and we were trying to figure out how to start doing policy work around that. And right about that time, there was transit cuts happening all over the country and in Santa Fe as well. And so we started a campaign to stop the service cuts and the fare increases that at the time City Council was trying to put forward. And that was really the birth of Chainbreaker's community organizing around policy, on transportation policy.
What were some of the successes that came out of that?
Well, I think that first year of community organizing was really one that was kind of baptism by fire. Our membership rose from nothing, from zero, to 300 in about the course of 2 months. It was really very sweeping transit cuts that were being looked at the time. The city council was really faced with a scenario in which almost all of the federal funding that they had for transit was gone. And so they were needing to figure out either whether to cut it or to support it here locally. So that was something that really spoke to a lot of bus riders that we were talking to that knew that this was their lifeline. This is how they got to work. This is how they got to school. This is how they got their groceries. And those cuts would have made serious impacts on their life and would have hurt them. So people really grew in strength and in participation in the organization. We were able to stop those service cuts and fare increases. And in fact, since 2009, we've been instrumental in making sure that every major service cut and fare increase to Santa Fe Trails has been stopped in its tracks. And we're just at the place now in having conversations about expanding transit and actually doing the work that we need to do to make sure that our transit system is not just serving where it has already served, but it's actually growing to a place where people can actually use it as its primary source of transportation without feeling like it's a burden.
Well, that's the thing in a town as small as Santa Fe with these gigantic buses. It's like the question of how you make that viable is something that you've probably looked at quite a lot.
Yeah, the truth is a lot of ridership goes up on our bus system. It's used quite a bit. People often look at it who aren't bus riders and they question where ridership comes from. They think of it as a chicken or an egg question. So a lot of times if you look, and this isn't just the case in Santa Fe, but all over the country, but here particularly, we have our Cerritos Road Line, number 2. It comes every 15 minutes and it's almost standing room only all the time. And so the more effective that a transit line is, the more service that it provides, the more accessible it is to folks, the more people ride it. I think in any city around the country, people make the choices that are easiest and make the most sense for them to get around. And if our cities are designed in ways that incentivize car driving and disincentivize transit, then people are going to make those choices unless they absolutely have no other option. And so that's why, to us, this is really an issue about social and economic justice, because we're really talking about transit. It's much bigger than just needing another line here or needing a few hours here, and all of that's true. But it really gets to the depth of the economic justice piece and the environmental justice about building our cities in ways that mandate car dependency or not.
When a city is already built, and like you've got New York, which is just has fantastic public transportation and places like that. And then you've got places, especially in the West, that grew up around cars. And Santa Fe, which grew up before cars were even invented. What does planning for public transportation look like?
Well, I think that that's why we need to look at this at a holistic space. And that's where Chainbreaker started evolving as well into talking about city planning and development and housing issues. Because you kind of can't talk about one without the other. As you said, we live in a city already that is built around cars, and most cars in this country are. There's very, very few that were fully matured by the time cars started coming around, and even those ones have been retrofit for cars. So what we really need to do is take a multi-pronged approach to it. So the first one is making sure that there's more buses more often. So that's just increasing transit in the areas that don't have transit already. So finding the need and increasing the service there. So that's one. That's how we deal with the cityscape the way that it is right now. But in the bigger picture, we need to look at things like ensuring that there's equitable resource allocation into all of our neighborhoods so that people aren't forced to travel as far as they need to currently in order to get to work or to get to the grocery store or to get to school or parks. So we need to make sure that we're thinking in terms of complete communities and not just where people are housed. And then in the biggest picture, we need to start thinking about how we actually can reshape our cities and incentivize instead of sprawl, but how do we bring people back into the city and create communities that are walkable, that are bikeable, where people can use transit in a way that is effective and that we don't have to be dependent on cars.
So one of the big projects that you guys are looking at and that a lot of people are talking about is the development or redevelopment, I guess, of the former College of Santa Fe property, that campus, 60 plus acres in the middle of Santa Fe. And the question of what is going to happen with that property, as far as I understand, is still open. There's still a lot of talk about it, and it's not really clear which of several directions or multiple directions it's going. And while it's a great opportunity for the city, there are also issues of equity, gentrification, and the kinds of things that you've been talking about with respect to transportation that you at Chainbreaker are looking at. And before we talk about the current issue, that campus, I was wondering if you could give us kind of a brief history of what gentrification has looked like in the past here in Santa Fe. Because I feel like each sort of wave of change in a city, so many people forget what happened like one or more generations before.
Yeah, that's right. So this campaign around the College of Santa Fe, the University of Art and Design property, is really the manifestation of so much of our work for the last 15 years. And I think you're right, it has a historical context of what's going on here. So first of all, we like to talk about gentrification. We like to define what that means for our community and why it happens. So we know that gentrification is displacing of people, usually low-income communities of color, outside of their traditional living areas. And this is not a unique phenomenon to Santa Fe. It's happened all over the country. It continues to happen to this day. But the way that it's happened in Santa Fe traditionally is that this legacy of displacement and gentrification really started in 1492 with colonialism, right? And it's kind of the same legacy. I think gentrification, in terms of how we think about it now, really has a lot of its roots starting in the 1940s, right after World War II. A lot of folks started noticing New Mexico as part of the United States, but feeling like it was somehow different. I think there's lots of cultural and historical reasons for that, but that was kind of where the myth of Santa Fe started getting sold to people. And so people started moving in here with more wealth and with more resources and buying up a lot of chunks of land around the downtown area that wound up, some of it happening in very malicious ways of outright just purposefully taking of land and homes from people and displacing the people that lived there. So we had a lot of farmland. We had a lot of sheep, shepherds in that area. And so as it grew into what has become the Santa Fe style of today, where we've become very heavily dependent on tourism to bring those dollars into the city, essentially commodifying the culture of the people who are living here, the sad truth is that the peoples whose culture it is have been slowly and steadily pushed out. And again, that dynamic has waves where it jumps up. So the time period we were talking about is there. There were others where there was giant booms of displacement happening. You know, we talk about the 80s and 90s, we talk about 2008. But the truth is, it's been a steady ongoing thing that continues to this day. So we talk about the historical trauma that comes with being uprooted and displaced from your home and your family. But it's not just historical, it's also current.
Well, right. And I mean, I remember when I moved here in the early 90s, housing was, at least compared to now, really quite affordable, but it's been going up in small and large jumps ever since. And, you know, we talk a great deal about how people who provide services like teachers and police and nurses and so on have been moving to Rio Rancho or to other less expensive towns than Santa Fe. As you say, this is something that happens all over the country. Towns and cities become popular, they have a boom, the boom has that downside. Are there successful models around the country or in other places for addressing this problem of gentrification and people who've been living there for many generations being pushed out?
Sure. I think there's a lot of really great work that's happening around the country and here locally as well. I think in order to really confront the issue of gentrification, we have to understand why it happens first. And we've really identified the root of that being a history of disinvestment in a neighborhood. So when you have a legacy of a neighborhood in which there's not a lot of resources, both public and private investments being put into it, so that's things like grocery stores, that's things like jobs, sidewalks, parks, all of those things, it winds up creating this cycle of poverty with folks there. And in many cases, like in my neighborhood of Hopewell Man, folks have been living here for many generations, but the resources haven't been allocated in a way that is equitable to the city. So it creates this vulnerable dynamic of the people living here.
Say more about what you mean by that, like disinvestment. What is being provided to some neighborhoods that's not being provided to others?
So transit is what brought us to this conversation, and transit is kind of a perfect example of it. So for instance, if you look at how our bus system works, the areas in which people are more likely to want to use transit because they can't afford their car, they can't afford the gas prices. You know, many people who come to Chainbreaker report spending as much as a third of their income on just on transportation for their cars to get around. A lot of those folks are living in areas where they don't have access to public transportation in a way that is actually usable. But our system is actually designed largely centered around downtown. And largely, we believe that that's because the job centers are there. And there's also the tourist industry, which is largely what Santa Fe is dependent upon, bringing in those dollars in here. So it creates this cycle of saying, well, if we have limited amounts of money to spend on transit, should we put it where we think the money is going to be generated? Or should we put it into the areas to lift up where the people who work in the city live? And so often the choice is made to put those money and resources into areas where we already have those resources, and we continue this cycle. And you can look at many different ways of public investment. Parks are another good example. When you see that we have on the airport road corridor, we have one regional park that's only been built one third of the plan that it's supposed to be built. You know, there's still two thirds of the Swan Park that still need to be built, but resources going into the rail yard, into downtown, parks distribution is really not done in an equitable way. You can look at sidewalks, you can look at almost every metric in order to see that. And so that's what we mean by disinvestment. And so this legacy of disinvestment creates a cycle of poverty and marginalization for folks living in those neighborhoods, and they're left without the resources in order to get themselves out of it, and really with many more barriers put up against them toward the same access to the political system as folks living out in different areas. And so it's just a vicious cycle that continues and perpetuates itself.
So let's talk about that in the context of this former College of Santa Fe, Santa Fe University campus. I call it College of Santa Fe because it was College of Santa Fe for so long and has a long and rich history, and it was Santa Fe University of Art and Design for such a short time. But anyway, this question of whether that piece of land will have affordable housing as part of its plan, that's part of it. But it's also, and perhaps more to the point, the bigger questions of what kinds of pressures will be put on the surrounding neighborhoods in the St. Michael's Drive area and the other areas around the campus where there is some public housing, there's low-income neighborhoods, there's a lot of old neighborhoods. How are you thinking about, and how are the members of Chainbreaker thinking about these neighborhoods surrounding the campus and the sort of upcoming development period?
Right. So again, as in terms of a history of disinvestment being the primary marker of what makes a neighborhood at risk of being gentrified, you know, what happens is then a sudden influx of resources come into a neighborhood, and the folks that are living there can't absorb the changes. Rents tend to go up. And then even for home buyers, homeowners, when they have property taxes go up, and just all of the resources in the neighborhood wind up increasing, all of the costs in the neighborhood wind up increasing, and the folks who have lived there, in many cases like my own generations, wind up not being able to absorb that and being pushed out. And that's really that legacy that's happened. So when we look at the dynamics around the College of Santa Fe property, the SFUAD property, there's two ways to look at it. So Hopewell Man neighborhood, where a majority of Chainbreaker members live, where I live myself, is the poorest neighborhood in the city. And it is centrally located and is directly across the street from the college campus. So again, with that history of disinvestment, we look at it as a potential concern that a sudden influx of resources, anytime you hear someone talking about redeveloping a neighborhood, that's often what you're hearing, right? Is that there hasn't been the resources there in the first place, so it needs to be redeveloped into that area. So when we hear that, a lot of our members look at that and say, oh no, this is going to be a crisis for our neighborhood. This is going to be the end of us. So that's one way of looking at it. We certainly are mindful of the displacement pressures that might be created by development of this property. But on the other hand, you know, we always start our membership meetings by saying, what would we do if we could control the conversation? How would things change if the people who are affected would be the ones steering the conversation? And so we decided to take that approach for this, because it's not just a matter of wanting to protect what we have already in our current neighborhoods and guard against gentrification, but there's a lot of issues in our can actually solve by developing this property. So we really need to come at it from a development without displacement perspective. So, you know, it's not that our neighborhoods don't need resources and don't need to have stuff come into them. We just need to do it in a way that protects us from being displaced. And at the same time, we can build and have a vision for what that property is, which is city-owned property that's public land, right? So we can have our vision about not only wanting to protect our current neighborhoods, but how do we bring some of the children who have been forced to move out of the city or move to the farther ends of town from some of the parents that live in this neighborhood, how can we bring them closer? How can we start solving this housing inequity crisis in a real way? With 64 acres of land, the potential is just astronomical. And so that's the approach that Chainbreaker is making towards this.
What are some of your thoughts on those very questions?
Well, I think we've been doing a lot of community outreach for the last decade around this. So we know pretty well what our community needs, right? The cost of living is too high. Rents are out of control for folks. People have a hard time paying them. People are dealing with a lot of discrimination. People are getting evicted for sometimes no reason. And so, you know, these are real issues that already we need to be kind of addressing. But the truth is, with that much land, we can talk about figuring out ways of making sure that there's truly affordable housing that is deeply affordable for the folks here. So it's not just the firefighters and the teachers who have at least some access to resources. We need housing for them for sure, but we also need housing for the restaurant workers, for the hotel workers, for all of the folks that really drive the engine of what Santa Fe is. And the truth is, we need some support there. So we have the opportunity with that much public land to have a lot more community control over it. And I think that that's what people are thirsty for. They're thirsty to really have a true voice into how development happens here in Santa Fe. Make sure that the community is in charge of and controlling not just the actual development of the property and what comes afterwards. People want to continue to have a voice in that and saying how it gets developed. But we also want to have a voice in how in the process itself. And I think that what that starts doing is it starts healing some of the divisions and tensions that have been brought up over this history of displacement and gentrification and frankly, some nefarious developers that have come in historically. People are remembering that. And so there's this tension between development and the community. And I think that this is really an opportunity to overcome that. And, you know, I mean, to answer your question directly, I think that there's a lot of interest for things like parks, for supportive services out there, particularly mental health services, for support for folks that are dealing with homelessness or confronting homelessness or on the verge of homelessness. There's a lot of need for these kind of things. So when we talk about housing, it's not actually just about the actual physical structures themselves. It's all of the things that contribute to a full community. So jobs, schools, childcare, elder care. Really, we want to look at this in a holistic way.
One of the things that has happened really from the federal level down to the local level and everything in between all over the country is that government, which is supposed to represent the people, often represents business, often represents developers. And there's this whole kind of rhetoric about how we are all supposed to be on the side of development and capitalism and all of these things, no matter what the consequences to ordinary people, and especially the most vulnerable people in our society, whom government really is supposed to be representing. You know, they're supposed to be not only doing economic development, but really representing all the people. How do you think about changing that conversation?
Well, I think it's a heavy lift, but it's a lot of times when we talk about these issues, and Chainbreaker's stance is always that housing is a human right. You know, we come out of this as a civil rights organization and a social justice organization. We are not a housing organization, per se. We are a civil rights organization, and that's our approach. And so the core of what is at the problem of displacement, of homelessness, of all of these issues that we're talking about is really the idea of housing as a commodity, right? That it's something that we should be able to buy and sell and turn profits on, and that that is the final bottom line that we need to see there. Now, this is the world that we live in. This is the country and society that we live in. So under that framework, we need to figure out ways of saying the truth is housing is expensive to build, and people are not going to be able to always afford it. And so if we really believe that housing is a human right, we need to find works around for that. And to me, what that means is figuring out how to subsidize through public dollars and public resources. How can we figure out how to get these supportive services to people, including housing? If we started thinking about housing in terms of infrastructure and not in terms of commodity, we would really approach this much differently. You know, we don't have a lot of pushback when people start talking about needing to repair our road infrastructure or needing to build new roads in order to get to new places. That's kind of thought of as just a public good. I think it's about trying to shift the culture and shift the mentality towards thinking about all of the needs that people have in a city. And housing is one of the most central of all of those things. And so I think it really is about changing the culture and changing the way that we build in Santa Fe. And our campaign around this, called Nuestro Corazón, which means our heart, it's the geographic center of the city, so it's right at the heart of the city. But the conversations is also about the heart of what is the people here in the city, right? Is that traditionally and historically, we don't look at housing as commodities. We don't buy homes as investments. We do it because this is where we want to raise our children. We want to die in these homes. We want to spend our lives there. It's really deeply part of who we are. And if we start changing our viewpoint from just the bottom line into what is the human aspects of this, then that is where we start healing some of these divisions that our city has faced for the last multiple decades.
It's very tricky to do that because I think, I mean, probably you or I or most of the people we know buy a house because we want to live in it and live there for a long time, maybe the rest of our lives. Other people buy houses for investment, or they buy houses to flip houses, or they buy out houses to put Airbnb in because that's the way they'll get the most return on investment. And to try to address that legally means to sort of question the motivations of everybody who is buying a house and qualifying for a mortgage, which is virtually impossible to do. So it really is a cultural shift that you're talking about.
It's true. It's a big change. And again, I think that it's not, we can take steps towards that, right? So a lot of what we need, whenever you have the conversation, when we say housing is a human right, people are going to say, how should we pay for it? I mean, the truth is we do live in a society that incentivizes the kind of stuff that you're talking about. It makes it easy and attractive for people to buy up homes and then flip them and sell them, which contributes to the displacement process. It incentivizes people doing things like having investment properties that they actually don't live in. They sit vacant for many months out of the year just because it's Santa Fe is a high, hot real estate market. But we allow that to do that through policy. To me, the answer is, how do we address this through policy, right? So there are some things that we can do here on the local level. There are things that we're going to need to change on the state level. But once we start having a commitment to housing and equity in terms of the human aspects of it, then we start thinking about policy shifts that we can protect against flipping homes, right? That we can protect people and keep them in their houses, that we can really shore up support for renters out there that are by far the most vulnerable to displacement. How do we support these people? What laws can we put on the books in order to make sure that the predatory rent increases and evictions are stopped? How can we put laws on the books that incentivize building and completing affordable housing? How can we write tax policy in ways that makes it hard for people to flip homes and that generates revenue for truly affordable housing? There are solutions to all of this. And you know, in the grand scheme, it's going to take a huge cultural shift, but we can start with small steps. And I think the College of Santa Fe Property is really a bold jump in towards doing some of that. It's really going to set the tone for how development happens, not just in Santa Fe, but actually in the rest of the country. People are looking at this. This is a very big piece of property with a lot of implications about how development can happen in the country. And so we really have the opportunity to set the tone and to create a precedent and a model for truly grassroots, people-centered developments, and to do it in a way that doesn't displace people.
Are people in other cities watching us?
Without a doubt, yeah. Santa Fe is, you know, we're the fourth largest art market in the country, I hear. We are one of, you know, we're a very international real estate market. Santa Fe is the capital. A lot of eyes pay attention to New Mexico and to Santa Fe in particular. And again, when there's a dynamic about this size of public property and a community engagement process that Chainbreaker is trying to lead with partners, including a lot of service providers and policy advocates and the city itself, that is really something that people are paying attention to. And I think that people are thirsty for that kind of community control, not just here in Santa Fe, but they're thirsty for it all around the country. And we're really in a movement moment right now where people are starting to pay attention to development potentials like this, particularly when there's a strong community engagement piece of it. So Santa Fe is really going to be leading the charge for that.
Very interesting. You know, I'm thinking about this in the context of climate change, and I'm thinking about it in the context of kind of the bubble economy and the boom bust that seem to be part of how the country has been run for, you know, centuries, really. And there will always be massive, terrifying downturns exacerbated by climate change and other things. And the people who are speaking out are people like Chainbreaker members. And I wondered if you could talk to us about your constituency. Like, you've got a lot of people who are working low-wage jobs, single parents, very challenged people in our city, in our community. One might think community organizing is yet another piece in somebody's day that they might not want to do because of the lack of time and resources, but that's not necessarily the case. Give us kind of a sense of your organization, what you're doing, how it works, how you work together.
So Chainbreaker is a membership-based organization. We have over 700 dues-paying members, and the bulk of those members are low-income people of color, and many of whom live in the Hopewell Man neighborhood and in the area and the neighborhoods up and down Airport Road corridor. So we are very much made up of and led by the people who are directly impacted by the housing crisis and by the equity crisis that we face in Santa Fe. So as an organization, we continue to grow and to gain those voices because we know that, you know, in Santa Fe, the majority of people are cost burdened by housing. You know, something like 50% of people pay more than 30% of their income on housing, and a significant number pay more than half of their income on housing. So that's not an insignificant number of folks. And our organization is there to try to organize people. And to me, organizing is really, it's not about changing dynamic or changing people's minds or anything like that. It's about collecting all of the thoughts, collecting all of the energy around something, and literally organizing it and focusing it towards one unified goal. And I think that that's what we do in general. And that's what we're trying to do with this Nuestro Corazón campaign, is really get the needs and the voices of the people who are going to be most affected by this development and center them. And so that means the people who are potentially at risk of being displaced if development happens on this property in a way that doesn't work for them, and also the people who will be living and working and learning on this property in the future. So the people who are really directly impacted by it, and they're also the folks that oftentimes don't have the same level of political access to the system as many other people whose voices are often heard over ours. So that's really our role here. And I think that it's true that people look at community organizing and they feel like it's a burden. And in some ways it is. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to do this kind of organizing. You know, folks have two or three jobs. They have kids. They have to take a bus that takes them 45 minutes to get to a meeting. All of these things are obstacles that make it hard for folks who are impacted to have their voices heard. But the truth is, there's so much energy and passion around this. People, despite these barriers, people come forward and they do. They come to meetings that are hours long after a whole day's worth of work. They sit around, they learn about what the policies are that are affecting their lives. What policies can we put in place to make these changes? How can we actually strategize to make the political climate one that is going to be open to the voices and the needs of these people. So all of that kind of organizing and structuring and strategizing and frankly dreaming is one that is people are really, like I said, thirsty and excited to participate in. And it's very humbling to be part of this movement.
How did you get into this work yourself, Tomas?
Well, I was born and raised here in Santa Fe. I think this issue of displacement was one that I grew up hearing a lot about. I don't think people use the term gentrification when I was a kid, but we were very aware of it. It's something that is to this day, like I said, happening and also very present in people's minds. So I kind of had those seeds planted by the generations of folks that came before me and that raised me. I live right now in a house that is in the Hopewell Man neighborhood. It's multiple generations in my family. My grandfather built it. My dad grew up in it. You know, my grandparents died in this house. It's very much part of who I am and my family legacy. So when we talk about having the people who are affected by this work being centered, you know, I am one of them, right? I'm going to be directly impacted by this. I'm grateful and very privileged to be able to own my home, but I am not going to be able to absorb the cost that will come with a redevelopment of a neighborhood that's not going to support folks like me. And so really, Chainbreaker members are out there. When we say we're made up of the people who are directly impacted, we think that that's, first of all, a political and moral imperative for us. We think that that is the right way to do things, right? We believe in self-determination. But in terms of a tactical approach, it's actually also more effective because people who are going to be impacted by this work, people who stand to lose their homes that have been in their families for generations, or people who are going to be evicted if their rent goes up, or people who are not going to be able to absorb those costs, they're not going to stop doing the work until they win. And so to us, it's also a tactical thing. So I came to this work out of necessity and out of the same passions and love for my community and my people that everybody else who came to Chainbreaker did.
You are having an event coming up, a community assembly on Saturday, the 22nd of June. Tell us about that. Is everyone invited? What's happening there?
Absolutely. So, you know, we center the voices of the people who are most impacted. And on some level, everybody's impacted by this. So whereas it's harder for a lot of folks to get to something like an assembly, and we're going to do our best to take down those barriers, everybody's invited. So what the assembly is it's not a conference. It's not where there's going to be talking heads telling people the way things are. It's actually going to be a popular education-based learning and building opportunity for people. So we're going to come together. We're framing it based on a policy that the city put forward a few years ago that we worked on called the Residents' Bill of Rights, which lists 5 pillars for how development should happen in the city. And so we're going to deep dive into that because the city already has some directives about how community engagement should happen and how development should happen in these ways. So we're going to deep dive into these already existing policies and really ask what that means for us in our community. So when we talk about affordability, HUD has one definition, but what do we think about affordability ourselves, the people on the ground, the people who are actually dealing with these issues? So we're going to have those conversations, and at the end of that, we're going to come out with the basics of what we're calling the People's Plan, which we're going to continue to build on to create a set of policy recommendations for the surrounding neighborhoods and development recommendations for the actual property itself. And so it's going to be the people of Santa Fe actually spearheading and directing that policy initiative. And that's what Saturday, June 22nd, is all about.
And if people want more information, they can go to chainbreaker.org. Is information about the assembly on your site?
It is going to be up soon. We had a technical glitch. The best way to get the information is through social media at this moment. And all of our handles are at ChainbreakerSF. So that's Twitter, that's Facebook, that's Instagram, and Snapchat. We have all of those handles there. But we do expect that our website glitch will be fixed soon and that information will be there as well. You can also come by or call our office, and that number is 505-989-3858.
Tomas Rivera is Executive Director of the Chainbreaker Collective in Santa Fe, chainbreaker.org. Anything else you want to let people know before we go?
Just that we're really excited about this assembly on the 22nd. We hope to get a large turnout. This is really democracy in action. So when we talk about people-powered development, this is what it is. So we hope that you will be part of that.
Tomas Rivera, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.